two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why, hello there. It's your old pal, Sarah Silverman, and I'm back with a brand new season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast. On my podcast, I am talking about everything. Politics? Yeah, we get into it. Favorite sandwich shop in L.A.? I know a few spots, and I'm going to tell you about them. I'm also going to be talking to you. I will be reacting and responding to listener voicemails in real time. Let me tell you, things can get weird, and I love every second of it. Weird is my comfort zone. The newest season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Welcome to The Bubble. I'm your host, Andy Slavitt. If you heard some Australian voices and some clicking of action, that's because right now we're all on 60 Minutes Australia. That's right, there's a 60 Minutes in Australia. I'll tell you about that in a second. But first I want to tell you about a great show we've got today. Ed Young, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on COVID journalism, who's amazing, and I'm sure all of you, or many of you know who he is. He's a writer for The Atlantic. It has been quite an interesting week, as if they're all not interesting. First of all, go back and listen to the Tony Fauci episode if you haven't, or play it again. Why not? Let me tell you about the announcement that the president made on Thursday. Now, I'm actually recording this on Wednesday, but because I've been working on the announcement, and because this is playing on Monday, I can go ahead and talk about something that's not yet public, because we're in a bit of a time warp. You've probably heard already, but I'll give you some of the highlights. A big focus, number one, on vaccinating the unvaccinated through a series of, I'd say, more assertive vaccine or test requirements. What does that mean? That means for businesses, 100 employees or more, for venues, there are going to be a requirement that people who enter are either vaccinated or they're tested. Now, as I've talked about before, I think that's a very reasonable compromise to keep people safe because, as we know, a lot of people can't get vaccinated because they're under 12. So, big, bold move. As I record this, I am not able to tell you what the outcry was or the reaction over the weekend. I'm sure there was some that's predictable. But it's a bold move that I think a lot of people are also applauding and saying, you know, it's time we do this and move forward. The second category of things the president talked about was furthering protection for the vaccinated. And I think we have kind of a whole set of conversations that we've been having around boosters, masks, other kinds of things to make sure that even as immunity wanes, people are continuing to be safe. Third, keeping schools open safely. The president was about as strong as he could be in saying that he strongly urges school districts to have vaccine requirements. That is something that I think was probably not popular with the teachers' unions, but important for him to say and do, and I think it probably, maybe at the extent of his authority, testing and masking. But let me talk about testing, both to increase testing and to make sure that it's available at a low cost at a number of retail outlets. So I think we're going to really need to see that kind of testing get ubiquitous. And then he talked about a couple of other things that are very important, things that will help focus on the economy and economic recovery and improving care for those with COVID. Now, I think these were big, bold steps. I can't tell you how well they played politically. I do think this is the president trying to seize back control of the narrative that has sort of gotten away a little bit. But this is good policy. This is good, strong policy. Not everybody's going to agree with it. Not everybody's going to love it. So it brings me a little bit to my conversation on the program when on 60 Minutes Australia on Sunday just completed that interview. A lot of tough and interesting questions about what we experienced here in the U.S. and kind of what advice we have for people in Australia. Basically, just a nicer version of Americans, people in Australia, right? They're just nicer, but they've got the same sets of issues. They've got, obviously, indigenous populations. They've got sort of this sort of freedom-loving spirit that we do here and a sort of state-by-state system. And they're sort of in 2021 dealing with a lot of the challenges that we're dealing with there. So go get you on that YouTube if you want to see what I had to say. I haven't seen it yet because I just recorded it. In any case, let us get to Ed Young. I think you're going to love this. It is a very dynamic, in-depth conversation, almost a debate at times. Ed is just so smart and has so many opinions, which I respect. But we were able to sort of take each other on. And I think the best moments on the show are when we kind of forget that we're recording and we kind of have these arguments. And hopefully we got to that. I think you'll really enjoy it. Ed is just a treasure. So, Ed, you know, I think I speak for a lot of people to say that your kind of in-depth thoughts and analysis have become probably one of the mainstays for people who really want to understand things.
Thank you.
And I'm not even going to mention this small little prize that you won. I'm not even going to mention it. Maybe I'll mention it later.
That is also how I refer to it. I still can't quite say the word. So that's better for everyone.
Better for everybody. What did we get wrong going into this year? We kind of thought we'd be in a very different place right now. What didn't we see?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I think, you know, just thinking back to the start of this year, we were obviously still in the middle of the winter surge, but I think that people were pretty hopeful by the time the spring rolled round because of the initially fast rollout of vaccines and because that winter surge seemed to have subsided. I think that, I think people were buoyed by an administration that seemed to be taking things seriously, by the arrival of vaccines that were more effective and that had been developed more quickly than anyone had anticipated. But I think the mistake that we made was to put all of our eggs into that vaccine basket, you know, almost to the exclusion of other things. Like even last year, people were talking about the Swiss cheese model of pandemic defense, where you have lots of different countermeasures working together, each complementing for the holes of the other. And I think we forgot that. I think we really thought that the vaccines were so effective that they could act as a single layer. And I think because of that, we began letting our guard down and stripping some of the others away, masks most notably. But I think even, you know, we're now in a situation where testing is still insufficient, where, you know, we're still having to beat the same drum about everything else at a time when vaccination rates have stalled. And, you know, I don't think these are new errors. I recently went back and looked at the piece I wrote in September of 2020, America's Trapped in a Pandemic Spiral, in which I identified 9 errors of intuition that we were repeatedly making and that were costing our pandemic response. And the very first one was serial monogamy of solutions. Like we were just bouncing from one thing to the next and not putting multiple layers in place. And, you know, at the time, some of the things that we were bouncing from were ludicrous, like hydroxychloroquine. But it's telling that even at a time when we actually had very efficient countermeasures, the vaccines, we really went all in on them. And I think a lot of sociologists of science, a lot of like social epidemiologists would not be surprised by this.
Yeah.
You know, I think Sorry, go on.
No, just to double click a second. I mean, we thought we found a piece of cheddar cheese. We thought we found a really hard block of
right, yeah,
sharp cheddar.
Right,
we could put it in front of all the Swiss and drop and get rid of all the Swiss because
that's right.
And right, I mean, because remember in December, November last year, we said, oh, 96% effective vaccine, right?
Right,
and that headline. I'm curious how you think about how we could have done this, but I feel like we didn't say, is that against getting the virus? Is that against getting the disease? We didn't really explain what that meant. It sounded like, hey, piece of cheddar cheese, as soon as we give it to you, game over, right?
Right. And I think there's obviously two, like, I think probably three important things there. One is that, only half the country got the cheese, right? So that one layer for a start is only protecting one in two people. So even if it was perfectly protective, which of course it's not, that would be a big issue. And of course, it's not perfectly protective. Even back then, I agree that there were issues with how well people communicated what the vaccines were actually protecting against and how much protection they were offering. But, you know, even taking the highest of those numbers, it's not perfect. That your block of cheddar still has holes in it. And then, of course, we have variants that you have variants like Delta that are eroding into some of the effectiveness that the vaccines once had. So, all of those factors put together mean that for an individual, the vaccines are still extraordinary, right? The people who are listening to this who have been fully vaccinated have done the single best thing that they can to try and protect themselves. But it means that societies cannot simply put all of their eggs in the vaccine basket. And there are good sociological reasons for doing that. And there's just some basic mathematical ones, like just the simple numbers of Delta spread mean that this cannot be our only solution. And, as I wanted to say earlier, like this is sort of part of the modern American malaise that we regularly and repeatedly look for biomedical panaceas that are going to lead us out of massive problems that are like hugely social in nature. Like we look for the one drug or the one vaccine or the one thing that you put in your arm and that makes everything better. Sometimes it works, but that leaves behind a huge bedrock of social weakness and vulnerability that goes unaddressed.
Well, this comes directly from your article, and of course, my book, which by the way I quoted you directly a number of times, had a lot to deal with. We're not going to get better until we figure out how to care about one another and the impact of all of this mm-hmm. on one another. Because otherwise, if you don't, then there's really no point. Then none of these measures are going to get adopted by people who don't feel like they're at risk and likely to die. And so, but if that, when that chip is gone, you get increasingly sort of pushed into this view that I need a long ball solution because I can't count on my common citizen any longer. And this was proven, I think, really by Delta. So if I go back to last year and I listen to all of the podcast episodes and I read through all of the scientists I talked to, nobody was talking, at least at any real depth, about mutations to the virus getting worse except one person. And that one person I thought was just the biggest curmudgeon and downer, and I didn't even want to listen to him. It was Bill Joy, and Bill Joy said, everyone's saying these viruses get better and better and less harmful over time. It actually is going to work the other way here. And nobody else was saying that, and so nobody was really wanted to listen to Bill. But what happened is, you know, I think to some extent we created a cheddar cheese for the lesser virus. But I don't think we foresaw a 2021 with a worse virus, or did we? How did we miss that?
I mean, I think certainly towards the end of the year, a lot of people I was talking to, you know, were taking that possibility seriously. I do think that if I forget this during this answer, like, remind me to touch back on this individualism and collectivism issue that you raised. But to address the variant thing, I think that possibility was in the air. But I think that you can see some of the same issues that plagued hampered our initial response to the vanilla coronavirus back in early 2020 at play in our response to Delta. I think one researcher, Sam Scarpino of Northwestern, posited to me that in part of it is just this very Western hubris that, you see a new variant crop up in India and absolutely devastate it, and somehow think that that's not going to be a problem in the US. Maybe because some people, like the country, was quote unquote highly vaccinated, even though half of people were still not in that category, or because there was some assumption about relative quality of medical care on offer to people. Whatever the reason, in 2020, we saw the original virus tear its way through East Asia and did not do enough. This year, we saw a variant tear its way through South Asia and did not do enough. And once again, we don't have enough testing. Once again, we have debates about masking and all the other interventions that are on the table. And I think there's something to this idea about hubris being part of the equation.
I think you even said last time you were on the show, we talked about this sort of propensity for wishful thinking.
Right.
Which is a slightly different thing than hubris, but it may be true that the wishful thinking only works in a country that has the level of hubris to think that they can solve every problem, it doesn't affect them. So you have the luxury of wishful thinking.
I think that's right. I think the wishful thinking, the hubris, however you want to describe that, works very synergistically with the biomedical bias that we've already talked about, right? Like if you really are used to thinking about the products of biomedicine solving your health problems for you, then in a situation when vaccines are widely available, I'm not surprised that you're going to think that you are therefore shielded from the worst excesses of some new form of this virus. And then, like, the third piece to this equation, besides the hubris and the biomedical bias, is this, like, penchant towards individualism that you raised earlier. I think that is absolutely crucial. You know, you asked me at the start of this, what did we get wrong? And I talked about the serial monogamy of solutions. If I could have picked another thing, it's this this tendency to go for rugged, toxic individualism over the kind of collective actions we need to actually defeat an infectious disease. And we saw this from some of the highest echelons of power in this country. You know, like some, like Trump, who is the, like, America's id in human form, is gone. But despite that, many of his successors are still hewing to similar kinds of rhetoric. You know, when the CDC made its controversial and I feel ill-advised decision to change its initial guidance about masking indoors for fully vaccinated people, the rhetoric coming from people like Joe Biden and Rochelle Walensky was very much about this individual responsibility thing. You know, your health is in your hands. The choice is yours to vaccinate or not. Obviously, this is an infectious disease. Like, your health is not fully in your hands. You know, it depends.
So let me risk entering into a slight debate with you on this. And the only piece that I would be is that, like, if you believed that you had a reasonable piece of cheddar cheese, and you believed that 60% of the country was willing to take it, and 40% could have but didn't, at some point in time, do you say? And by the way, with before Delta, where you could become infectious and symptomatic, right? Which is a difference. At some point in time, as a political leader, do you have to say, look, we've given everybody the choice. We can't now. The people who are unvaccinated are at risk. The people who are vaccinated are much, much less risk. We can't let the people who choose not to get vaccinated disrupt society for everybody else.
Yeah. So I think that there may be some time in the future when that question becomes much more pertinent than it is now. But I don't think it applies now, and I don't think it applies
right
back
but
then.
That's the Delta surprise, isn't that?
No. I think it's the fact that even now, so there's a few things. Like, even now, access is still an issue. Like, eligibility for vaccination does not equate to actual access. And there were a lot of barriers in terms of poverty, in terms of location, and in terms of, like, there were a lot of factors that explained and still explain why a lot of people were unvaccinated. And to bill it simply as a matter of personal choice, and by extension, billing unvaccinated people as this kind of monolithic block of people who had just, you know, flipped the bird to the biomedical community or advice from experts, I think is just fundamentally wrong. It was wrong. And I think it still is wrong. And it was very, very wrong when that measure first came out.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts, behind-the-scenes segments, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through all of our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
Yeah, no. So putting aside the CDC measure and guidance, what I'm trying to do is basically push to the point of look, it's where England is right now in saying. That at some point in time, an elected leader will say, "We've done our jobs. There's more to do. You know, we haven't gotten everybody out of Afghanistan, but we've gotten most. We haven't gotten everybody vaccinated, but we've got free vaccines within 5 miles of everybody in the country, and we're pushing. But in the meantime, the risk is low, and I think, before Delta, And before, I think there was some sense that there was some waning of the vaccine. And I'll come back to all of what potentially has changed with you, because those may or may not be the right things. There was a false sense. It wasn't correct, but there was a false sense of that there's some stability. And so in retrospect, your point is right. We jumped, we jumped the gun. We all made this mistake. But I don't think that implies that the administration saw the unvaccinated monolithically or wasn't making tremendous efforts at health equity. But I do think they were saying, when I was, was there at the time, so this is why my defense of this is a little bit suspect, is that hey, at some point in time, we gotta set a goal, get people where we are, and then have a chance to move on. And if it wasn't for Delta, things could be quite different right now. Do you agree with that?
I agree that Delta has changed the game, but I don't think I agree that even in the absence of Delta, some of the rhetoric was justified. I still think that it centers people who had already been vaccinated at the time, including people with the earliest and easiest access to vaccination. I think that public health is a discipline that is meant to center equity at its very core, at the foundation of everything it does. And I think that the guidance that was issued failed in that respect. And I think finally that I just simply feel that that even if you put all of that aside, I think what you need from a leader during a crisis like this is rhetoric that calls on community action and collective spirit, that it must be emphasized at all times that we are in this together, and that even people who have the privilege of immunological protection cannot tap out of the collective game. I feel like the mistake was creating policies that were geared towards almost letting them do that. And look, I am fully vaccinated. I wanted to be able to do that. But I also understand that that's not, I don't necessarily think that my needs and wants should be at the core of decision-making at the highest levels of government. I think that decision-making should center people with who were most vulnerable, who had the least opportunities, who were struggling the hardest. I'm not sure you can look at the decisions that were made in sort of May and June and say that was in fact what happened.
Yeah, I look hard to argue with a lot of those points. I'll give one more college try at one element of this, which is it's very clear that if public health leaders were making the rules and making the decisions, that you might call things one way, and you might be able to be conservative beyond a shadow of a doubt, 70%, 80%, 90% conservative. But here's what I'd say. When you're at a point where half the country is vaccinated and wondering why the hell they can't get on with their lives, and the other half of the country is not vaccinated and saying, I don't trust the thing, and saying they're not going to move, you've got 100% of people unhappy. And it's hard for political leaders, whether it's, particularly when I think at the time the curve in Israel, we were seeing one death, zero deaths a day. And people were able to look at that, and scientists were all looking at that and saying, and yes, they missed the India piece. They called that due to the lack of vaccination. But it's very hard for any leader at that point in time to say, I'm not doing right by people by saying that. So anyway, that's not a...
I think
more of an explanation than it is a justification.
I think one thing that we can absolutely agree on, and I will fully and readily stipulate this, is that this is hard, right? Like, I'm not for a minute saying that these decisions are easy to make, nor am I even really saying that all of public health agrees, right? I've spoken to public health experts who I think have a much more charitable view of the stances that the administration took at that time, and you know, who feel differently. I don't get the sense that they are in the majority, but that, you know, there again, even in public health, there is not a monolith of opinion here. So yes, let's stipulate that it is very difficult to make these decisions. I think that you know, in addition to the centering of equity piece, one thing I do think we've been bad at, like all round, has been just grappling with uncertainty, like in a true and meaningful and careful way. I think this, you know, the calculus of whether to what extent to what extent vaccinated people could tap out of that collective game, depends substantially on questions like, can they transmit? And I don't think we actually knew the answer to that with any kind of certainty. And it was a question that needed answering, and now seems to, you know, and now we obviously have some of that evidence. But I think it's not that we can say with hindsight, like, we knew that that wasn't the case back then. It's that we didn't know.
Right. And I'll allow you this, which is that as a politician, and I'm not a politician, but observing politicians, even the best of them, that there is a temptation when people are saying, please make this over. Please end this. Please make this over. This is a horrible experience, and it's getting in the way of everything in my life. Politicians, even the non-populist id variety, are tempted to figure out how to see the world in a way which makes it feel like they've won. And and so, you know, if world leaders knew that Delta was coming and so forth, they would have played it differently. The advice from scientists at the time was, "Oh, the vaccine handles Delta, and the virus doesn't transmit among vaccinated people." Those were obviously conclusions that people that should have been looked at more skeptically. But anyway, I think it was a great. This is the right debate and conversation of how politically to do this. I've been very critical of President Trump because he followed base instincts to the point where he would lie about reality in order to kind of please a populist base. But even a non-populist politician, just by nature of being a politician, does take into account public sentiment. And, you know, politics is reflective of culture, not the other way around, right? Politics didn't invent any of this. But the politicians observe and react. And in this case, that doesn't lead you to making the tough decisions all the time.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So let's talk about Delta and what we know about it, what we don't know about it. Maybe start with some parts of it that we don't understand. There appears to be, with Delta, as with other waves, kind of a life cycle that I think people ascribe to for various reasons that I'm still not convinced we understand, which, you know, we saw most significantly in India, and we've seen it in Indonesia, where we have very quick growth of Delta followed by a very quick decline. We saw it in England, although for some reason that reversed itself in the middle. We are observing the beginnings of that in the southern part of the U.S., where we're seeing kind of this decline. What do we know, Ed, either scientifically, sociologically? Like, what's their explanation for this phenomenon that these waves seem to pass like this?
Yeah. Okay. So in the spirit of embracing uncertainty, I'm going to say that I don't know, but I've got some like reasonable guesses for some of it. I think interpreting like individual trends for specific places has always been one of the hardest challenges about the pandemic, because there are so many different factors that go into it, not least of which is just plain old stochasticity. And I'm not sure we have the data to fully explain like any one of the trends that you mentioned. Like, you know, if you have a spike that reverses quickly, is that because so many people got infected that the virus just ran out of hosts? I mean, for something as transmissible as Delta, I wouldn't rule that out. I'm not saying that's implausible. I'm not really sure I would put a bet on it either. My go-to hypothesis would be that something about people's behavior changed. You know, it's just a sort of more radical version of the patterns we saw through much of last year, where and there is some data on this, that much more than like top-down policy, what especially when such policy was often weak and ineffective, what really moved things was the virus would enter a community, a lot of people would get sick, people would see the people around them getting sick and then take their own action. Like, we saw multiple cases last year where people's behavior changed in advance of policy measures coming in. We saw that at the very start in March, where, you know, businesses shutting down, people were staying at home even before big statewide orders were enacted. And I think that's part of a trend that you see a lot, like people react to the situation around them. I think it's why things turned around in parts of the Midwest in the fall. I think it's, you know, it may be why some of the peaks that we saw at the start of this Delta surge in certain states started turning around. But, and I think like my gut is to always look at behavior as being the null hypothesis. So if you look at what happened in the UK, you know, it was bizarre on one hand that on Freedom Day, when everything was lifted, cases started falling. But I think cases started falling because the Euro Cup was over, and because people who had previously been flocking into pubs and watching games and infecting each other then went home. And I think there is some evidence to bear that out. Like, there's been a lot of other explanations for that too. I would highly recommend a piece that my colleague Sarah Zhang wrote in The Atlantic, where she talks a lot about these different hypotheses. But, you know, cases fell back down, possibly because people stopped watching this gigantic football tournament in which England got to the finals. And then Freedom Day happened, and with the predictable lag after that, cases have started rising again. I think, I'm not sure that pattern is actually that difficult to explain. It sort of fits with, you know, what we think about the virus. But I think just in general, I think my main point here would be that these individual patterns are difficult to explain. There's a lot of different variables at work. I think usually when people try and offer like one single thing that explains like the ups and downs of any particular curve, you're going to run into problems. Like, there's just a lot of different factors at work, and I'm not sure we're really good at teasing them apart at the moment.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the dough, where Cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season two is here. Hosted every week by me, ex-Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season two of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's funny, the last time you were on the podcast, and by the way, everything on the podcast is still relevant, so go back and listen to it if you're listening to this. One of the things you and I talked about was this phenomenon where step one, observe data. Step two, insert favorite theory. Right? And it's right. Like, oh, Florida versus California. This is obviously what's happened. This is obviously what's not happened. And there's, as you described so eloquently, there's way too many factors, way too heterogeneous. There's way too many cases, and so like your theory, I listened to your theory, and it's the most, you characterize it appropriately as the most probable. And then there's another theory, which is, you know, husband and wife, husband with a bad case of COVID, they sleep together, wife never gets COVID. So, or vice versa. So there's something that makes some people more susceptible than other people. Now, if I were going to argue that rationale, I would say if something like that exists, it's a whole lot more solid than any kind of consistency in human behavior, given that people's behavior is pretty much, you know, I'm going to do as much as possible. That I can do. Many, many people underestimate the risk of COVID. Many, many other people, and then you've got a phenomenon like school starting up in the South. Not be a time I would be predicting cases would be going down. There's all kinds of things that are indeed happening, but there, it feels to me like there's something unexplained, and your hypothesis may be correct. The hypothesis I just reviewed, which isn't my hypothesis, but other people have of course talked about this. It's not necessarily the right answer, but it feels like there is there's a missing piece of information that exists. And you're right, it may not be the one piece of information that explains it all, but it could explain a good deal of it.
Oh, I mean, I think there's a ton of missing pieces. Absolutely, still, at the individual level, I think what you say is correct, that there are almost certainly going to be huge individual differences in vulnerability to the virus, so that some people will be surrounded by viral particles and not get sick. Some people will get very sick and end up in hospital. So yet others will develop long COVID. I think all of these things are very hard to predict right now. You know, I don't think you could take a person, an individual, and say this is your risk of developing any of these outcomes. Like, age gets you somewhere, but it doesn't get you everywhere. And then if you look beyond the individual, which I absolutely think you have to, things get even more complicated. Like, the, you know, everything we talked about before about the importance of social epidemiology, like understanding how class and race and the nature of people's networks, how all of these things affect infection risk, I think is massively underappreciated.
Right. Like, wouldn't it be good to know to collect data on what portion of people in the service economy versus in the salaried economy, by service, I mean people who get paid by the hour, are getting COVID.
Yep.
There are clearly some sociological variables that if we could see them with the naked eye, because we knew, we were all knowing, we might say, aha, 70% of the country is not allowed to even isolate because of the nature of their jobs. And they're the ones that are almost entirely getting sick.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you just have to, I think, like, all of these analyses just have to be multivariate. And if they're not, like, you're just going to stumble into a conclusion that might not be wrong, but will certainly not be entirely right.
Well, yeah. You know, well, if you're on Twitter, it's absolutely right because there's a lot of certainty.
I try to not be on that as much as possible. I think, you know, my hope, what the pandemic has taught me is how complex the etiology of disease can be. Even for something like this, where we know it's one virus causing one thing, you know, it's still so hard to explain why any one person is sick, to explain why any one community is seeing the patterns that it does, because there are just so many different overlapping latticed factors that go into explaining any of those trends. And, you know, one of the most important lessons I take away from this is that it is hard, and that factors like, you know, the sociological variables that we've talked about are often underconsidered. And I think the lesson that some folks who will remain nameless have taken away from this is that this is easy. Like, I've been, you know, looking at a few graphs on Twitter for the last few months, and I am now much more of an expert than these so-called experts who,
I found the one time that they were wrong and I was right. And therefore,
right, I'm smart. You know, there just seem to be a lot of armchair polymaths out there who, you know, spent the last year and a half getting advanced degrees in epidemiology, immunology, sociology, and all the rest. Yeah. And
and if it wasn't bad enough that we've now all become these armchair experts in virology and immunology and all of these other things, now the next great field of expertise it's clearly developing is evolutionary biology.
Right.
So, let's talk about that for a second. I mean, in the battle between the virus and the vaccine and natural immunity, which are the virus's natural enemies, right? Mm-hmm. What do you see happening? There's a school of thought that put forward by many of the anti-vax community that the reason we're having variants is entirely because of the vaccine. So we can start with that one posture, and then there are flavors of that aren't quite so. I won't say what I think of that theory, but that aren't quite so extreme. That really relate to how slowly or quickly we vaccinate the world will have give a chance for the vaccines to feel, the viruses to feel the pressure to evolve. So, before I go any more armchair, help.
All right. I will say that I will do my best to answer this question. If your listeners want a much better, longer, and more considered answer, I would strongly recommend a piece that my colleague Katie Wu just wrote at The Atlantic called The Coronavirus Could Get Worse, which is, you know, obviously a somewhat alarming headline, but it is absolutely a piece that looks very, very deeply at the evolutionary possibilities ahead of the virus, and I think does justify that you know, this idea that, yeah, then things could get worse, like you said earlier, like it's not just the case that it's very early on last year people were telling me rightly that, you know, you cannot predict which way this is going to go, like evolution could make things better or worse. Worse is always on the cards. You know, as to the question about vaccines, let's take that idea, let's for a second take that idea seriously and not dismiss it. Like, I think at the core of that idea is the assumption that the virus will only evolve the ability to escape to escape from immunity, if it gets into someone who already has some degree of it, so if it finds the selection pressure around it to become better at immune escape, it will do that. And the corollary of that is that if the virus doesn't have that pressure, if it's just in people who have no immunity, then why would it evolve the ability to escape from it? I think that idea is totally understandable, but also wrong, because we know that viruses mutate spontaneously all the time. We know that they are, without deliberation, of course, like just testing out different mutational routes that they could go down. And that occurs in people who are unvaccinated and vaccinated. And one model for how the evolution of the virus could occur, which I think is right, is that a bunch of mutations happen just as part of the natural course of the virus infecting someone. And viruses with the right constellation of mutations to have some degree of immune escape then get into people with the degree of immunity and can spread from there, right? So I think the point here is that the trait that might evolve doesn't have to first arise in the arena where the selection pressure is strongest, right? It can just arise elsewhere and then gain a foothold or find an advantage somewhere else. Which is all a long way of saying that, no, I think that idea is wrong. I think that it is much more likely that if we continue allowing the virus to spread uncontrolled, which mostly happens in unvaccinated populations, the more chances it will have to evolve into worse variants. I don't think it's the case that the vaccines triggered the evolution of bad variants like Delta and Alpha. Quite the opposite. I think that that does make, however, a very strong argument for getting the pandemic under control as quickly as possible and as wide a swath of the world as possible, which is yet another reason why all these calls for vaccine equity are so, so important. The US cannot and should not consider itself protected, even if like magically everyone in the country who was, yet to get their vaccines decided to do so tomorrow, the pandemic still wouldn't be over for us because it wouldn't be over for other people either. Like, again, it comes back to this idea of connectivity and community. We are still very much in this together.
So that's obviously a very hot topic right now. And maybe let me lay the stage for where that conversation sits and then ask you about it. We've done about 5 billion vaccines across the globe, 75% of them in 10 of the wealthiest countries, but we're now vaccinating about 36 million people a day. It's mostly centered in Asia, but if you did 36 million a day and continue to be able to do 36 million a day, that's about a billion every month. And if you did about a billion every month and you could continue that in Africa, where we have the lowest vaccination levels, then you would be able to ostensibly get the world vaccinated in the very early part of next year. Now, for everyone's baseline, the G20 is sort of said that it'll be the end of 2022 before we get the majority of the world vaccinated. And that's just simply too long. But the implication of that, and if you follow those numbers and all and believe those numbers, is that we are producing enough vaccines to vaccinate the globe. But that doesn't mean we're going in the early part of next year, but that doesn't mean we will. Because the logistical barriers, the same things that we inherited in the Biden administration in the U.S., the cold storage, the logistics, the distribution in the developing world is a monumental task. And myself, along with the people from PEPFAR and others, are about to release. In fact, we just released a letter to the world leaders in advance of the United Nations meeting here in September, saying that the world needs to work together to vaccinate the globe by the early part of next year. And it is indeed possible, but a lot of things need to happen that aren't happening now, namely unified leadership around solving some of these very hard problems. So with that as a backdrop, every time a vaccine dose doesn't go into someone's arm brand new, as you said, we are increasing the risk that new variants evolve. And at the same time, of course, the wealthy nations are saying, no, we want to yet do our third vaccine dose. So inherent in this question for you, Ed, is there's a lot. There's, does immunity wane? There's what's the highest and best use of vaccines? And there's really how to manage this challenge globally.
There is a lot of to unpack there. And again, you know, I do want to defer to colleagues of mine who've done more reporting on these particular things. I've already talked about Catherine Wu, and she has done fantastic work on many of the intricacies of how the immune system reacts to the vaccine. She's working on a piece about waning immunity now. So I'm going to touch on these issues in a broad way. What I want to say, based on my own reporting, is that I think it is very clear that the impact of a booster shot, the impact of a vaccine shot, is going to be much greater in someone who has received zero than in someone who has received two. I think Eleanor Murray, an incredible epidemiologist and statistician at Boston University, has crunched these numbers very well and very tellingly, I think, and shown, to my mind, very convincingly, that the effect of a booster is going to be pretty incremental as compared to the impact of vaccinating someone who is fully unvaccinated. And I think because of the dynamics you have already identified, the sheer number of people around the world who remain unvaccinated, including high-risk groups in many countries, I just don't think one can morally justify having a widespread booster campaign in a country such as this when there is so much of an equity issue at play around the world. I think that and making efforts to reach, continue reaching unvaccinated people in this country, and continue the steady but unabated progress on that, should be our main goals. And I think that's going to achieve more in the long run, for people, more, you know, for the entire global community, than giving people who are already vaccinated and who have, you know, some degree of immune privilege a bit of extra personal protection. And again, this goes back to the individual versus collective idea, right? Like, what is the best thing for me, a fully vaccinated person right now? Well, for me, it might be to get a third shot. That might, you know, I don't think that's going to... I haven't seen that enough evidence to say that that's going to make a huge difference, but it's not going to make like zero difference. But what is the best thing for the world right now? I think it's to get those shots to people who've never had them before. And by extension there, what is the best thing for me? It's actually to do that other thing, right? Because if we don't do that, then I do worry about the possibility of even worse variants arising that really do start punching through the whatever shield I currently possess. So, you know, I still think that it's in my self-interest to sort out the big picture.
To oversimplify, you know, the one way that I think it's possible to describe these terms is, are you willing to suffer symptoms if you know your risk of death is... and hospitalization is incredibly low in exchange for that benefit you just described, which is both a moral one, but also a longer term protective one. And because, you know, it's possible that, and do tell me if you agree with this, that a boost really keeps your antibody levels higher more quickly. And when you've got a much more rapidly spreading with a lower incubation period virus like you do with Delta, you could see symptom reduction. But are we taking first world symptom reduction and putting it against developed lives of developing countries?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair way of putting it. And I think my answer to your question is yes. Yes, I am absolutely willing to bear that risk. And I know there is a risk. But I also feel that, you know, it's not as if I don't have any other options besides get a booster or not get a booster and, you know, swan dive into a crowd of people indoors and get COVID. I think that I have options, as you know, as that are afforded to me by living in a prosperous, wealthy nation.
There's a couple wrinkles. I'm sure you'd agree around the fact that we have 17% of our population is unvaccinated under 12 year olds who can't get vaccinated. And,
yes,
you know, and I think there's immunocompromised people, which are right. So,
yes, to be clear, the wrinkles are people who either did not fully benefit from two rounds of vaccine, like many immunocompromised people, or people who are at very high risk. So, like the elderly. I think that there is a strong moral argument for giving boosters to those populations, but not as a general policy for like the entire adult.
And how does long COVID figure into that? I know you just wrote a piece on long COVID. How does the risk of long COVID figure into that equation? Because people are fearful that if they get COVID, that those symptoms might stick around.
Yeah, people are very fearful, and I think rightly so. You know, I think one thing I say in this piece is that confident predictions about long COVID are unwarranted because so much is still unknown about it. You know, the only confident prediction that I'm willing to make to you is that it is a problem, right? And we still don't know enough about what causes it. Well, no, we know what causes it, but we don't know enough about how and why it occurs in general and in specific people to really make like big proclamations. So, for example, I think a lot of people, for a long time, the discussion about breakthrough infections has correctly been that they are going to be milder than cases of COVID in people who are not vaccinated. The common response from long hauler community to that has been, well, you said mild infections would not be a problem at the start of last year, and we know full well what a mild infection can do. We know that like an infection that doesn't send me to the hospital can leave me with symptoms for months, for years. So you know, this idea that mild infection, like breakthrough infections, are milder is of cold comfort. Now, to that, many of the immunologists and scientists I've spoken to have argued that a mild infection in a vaccinated person and an unvaccinated person are not the same and should not be treated as the same, because in the vaccinated person, that is the infection is mild after the immune system has already been stamping on the virus. Which should theoretically be different. So on that ground, you would expect the risk of long COVID to be lower after a breakthrough infection. But the wrinkle there is, as I said, we still don't know enough about long COVID. So one possibility is that it is essentially an autoimmune condition where you get exposure to the virus and your body, for whatever reason, your immune system, for whatever reason, starts attacking itself. The fact that there have been some cases of long COVID after in people who've been fully vaccinated, with a massive caveat that we don't know what the rate of those is at all, but the fact that there have been some might suggest that if the autoimmune theory is right, that it might only take a small amount of exposure to the virus to trigger it. So again, that brings us to the question of, okay, but what, like, if it, what risk does a milder infection pose? And I think because we still are in the dark of the, like, mechanistic causal links between seeing the virus and developing long COVID, it is very difficult to then predict how those dynamics will play out in a vaccinated person or in a situation in the future when the virus becomes endemic and just becomes a natural part of our lives. And it is therefore very difficult to answer this question of whether boosters would reduce the risk of long COVID or not. Like, my sort of gut reaction based on everything I've just told you is that if it is correct that a small amount of virus might be sufficient to trigger an autoimmune reaction that leads to long COVID in some people for whatever reason, then I struggle to think why having a third dose of the vaccine is going to make a difference, right? If that hypothesis were correct, then what's probably happening is that the amount of virus that's getting into your respiratory tract at the start, before it is controlled by the immune response that the vaccines trigger, which are mainly circulatory, before that happens, that amount is enough to trigger some kind of autoimmune cascade. And if that's the case, then boosting the vaccine-induced response isn't going to help matters, is my guess at the moment. But massive caveat, we really don't know.
That's right. It does complicate the booster. It does make the booster conversation versus using those doses in countries that haven't had their first shot slightly more complex.
I'm not actually sure it massively complicates the booster question. I think it complicates a lot of things. I think it complicates, like, our understanding of how to deal with the virus in an endemic future. It complicates, like, our...
Here's why I think it does.
Okay.
Look, one of the things that makes you such a great writer is you're a science writer that doesn't just write about the hard sciences, but you write about... people don't like when I say soft sciences. I've been corrected on this. Mm-hmm. But you write about the social sciences. You write about the interplay between the social sciences and the physical sciences. And, you know, one of those is political science. And, you know, the notion that, you know, taxpayers expect with their tax dollars, the government will do everything they can to protect them from things that put them at risk of getting sick. And that we have no central governance for the globe. We only have national governance. And if every wealthy country has citizens who are saying, you could protect me and you're choosing not to, that political science, particularly when there are valid concerns around things like long COVID, makes it more difficult to expect a politician to defy what essentially the concerns of their own population.
Right. But what I'm saying is that I am not convinced that there is enough of rationale to say that a booster shot would significantly reduce your risk of long COVID based on whatever we currently know to make that claim. I think that you're right that politicians absolutely should be factoring long COVID into their calculus about what policy measures to call for. But I think if you take that route, then you're much more talking about measures like other preventive measures, like the so-called term I truly despise, non-pharmaceutical interventions. You're talking about things like masks. You're talking about things like distancing. You're talking about more serious means of preventing infections in the community. I don't think that it naturally follows that if everyone was to suddenly take long COVID seriously, the natural recourse then is to go for a booster strategy. I think that a lot of long haulers would actually say the opposite. I think what they feel is that a lot of the decisions that have been made this year, including things like the CDC's initial reversal of its indoor masking policy for fully vaccinated people, those things were a reflection of the administration not taking long COVID seriously enough, and that prioritizing a much more holistic attitude towards the prevention of respiratory infections would be a much clearer indication of truly addressing the potential future threat of long COVID.
Yep. So I underestimate, and maybe you underestimate, I don't know if you do, but even if you don't underestimate, I suspect at times you might even forget how much the public can't stand, much of the public, non-pharmaceutical interventions. And of course you understand it because it goes back to the individual versus collective conversation. But I'm going to use it in a little bit differently, which is that there's a large part of the population, at least some of the data that I've seen, suggests that people can stomach NPIs like masks, et cetera, if they know they're temporary and if they serve a short-term purpose. And even then, you know, you got Governor DeSantis who doesn't want schools to require masks, et cetera. But by and large, the public isn't with him on that. But if you tell the public that this is going to be something that is going to be a new part of life, it is amazing how large parts of the population, in the U.S. at least, I haven't studied this in other places, really despise that idea. Is that going to change over time as people get accustomed to it? Or do you think, no, this is probably one of those things that is forcing us back to look at the physical sciences because there's really no way, there's really going to be no way to change people on that?
I often... Here's what I'll say to that. Regardless of how optimistic or pessimistic I feel about the possibility of that kind of change, I don't think that any of us have the luxury of pessimism with it. Because I think that if we cannot enact that kind of cultural change, we're screwed. I think we're screwed with a pandemic. I think we're screwed with climate change. I think we're really in problems if we can't address these problems in a more collectivist, more community-minded way. And I do think that is, if not likely, then certainly possible. And there have been signs of that possibility throughout the year plus of this crisis. You know, there have been signs of like very clear public support for masking and other such measures, especially during especially when surges are actually happening, which is when they're needed the most. Right. I think that considering this country's famous proclivities towards individualism, it is remarkable how many people wore masks last year from a baseline of nothing. I think that big social change is possible, even if it is unpalatable. But I think it requires strong, consistent leadership and messaging to put it in place.
Yes. Keep going. I'm sorry to cut you off.
No, I think the last thing I'll say about it is I don't know what is realistic to expect, and I don't want to make predictions about it. But I do maintain that if we cannot find a better way to address these issues, including many of the cultural flaws that we started talking about at the start of this interview, then this is not going to be the last time we have this conversation.
Right. To me, one of the questions this raises is this American exceptionalism, in quotes, or will we follow patterns in the rest of the world? Countries that have lived through horrible pandemics mask reflexively when they need to. People may not realize that in Hong Kong, the government did not require masks when the Wuhan outbreak occurred. And Hong Kong is the number one travel destination for Wuhan. It's right on the travel route. And it happened reflexively. And in places like San Francisco, which still has strong memories of the AIDS crisis, there was a much more organic response. Yes, London Breed, the mayor, was a very strong leader here, but she was leading a group of people that culturally got it. New York, having lived through the beginning of last year, probably feels differently. But you know, our problems probably won't be on the coasts necessarily in this country. That's not where the cultural problems exist. And the interesting question, and we're not unique. I'm sure there are parts of Australia and other countries that have some similar characteristics that face the same thing. Is there just something that's going to make this less likely or harder in America? And I agree with you that we don't have maybe not have the luxury of asking that question. But that's one of the things we're going to learn and have to figure out.
Yeah. Yep.
Let me close with one question. What should be our goal now?
The way I see it is this. Get as many people vaccinated as possible, as quickly as possible, and do everything we can to spread out infections among everyone else over as long a time period as possible. I think that's it. I think that at some point we will hit endemicity. You'll probably stumble into it. But that is the end point. I think we want to get there with as little damage as possible through some combination of vaccines and other strategies.
And you wrote about this, but I asked you to articulate this. At some point in time, a good scenario is that COVID-19 begins to be put into the category that we consider of our unfortunate but manageable challenges.
Yeah.
I live in Southern California. The traffic is horrible. Yet it doesn't prevent me from living my life. People who live in areas with extreme weather and other kinds of things, these are manageable challenges, but they don't dominate the day to day. I guess if you had to guess, when do you think we move into that state? And is it an even move? What do you see?
Look, I actually don't know the answer to that question, and no one I talk to could confidently make a prediction on that. What I do want to say, though, is there are a lot of things that we tolerate and that we don't let dominate our lives, but that maybe we should, not dominate, but that we can and should address to a much better degree than we currently do now. You know, you talked about...
I love that comment.
Right. You talked about extreme weather. I'm not sure anyone can look at the current situation and think like our preparedness for wildfires or for hurricanes or for any of these threats is going to leave us in good stead over the next century or so. So many people use this rhetoric of, when blah, 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 COVID is going to eventually get to a point where it's no worse than the flu, and we obviously don't shut down society for the flu. Well, firstly, no one's talking about shutting down society. And secondly, the flu is still a big deal. A bad flu season is a horrible experience, and a horrible experience that we have both normalized to and could not. You know, there are things that we do in our lives that are less than convenient, but that help us, you know, seat belts, like just generally, like washing our hands, like there's the applying sunscreen, brushing our teeth.
You make such a great point. I mean, the things we're willing to tolerate, school shootings, right, that we become accustomed to. We're now okay with the fact that 3,000 kids per week are getting admitted to the hospital, and we tell ourselves we're okay because most they're almost entirely not dying. So we're okay with 8-year-olds getting 104-degree fevers and struggling for breath and needing to get oxygen assistance and waiting hours in hospitals to do that. We're, you know, we become okay with things far too easily. So I think
and let me just end on this note, right? I think let's also be clear on what it means to normalize these things, because when we do normalize these things, the burden almost always disproportionately falls on the least socially privileged among us.
Like
minority groups, poorer rural groups, like that's always the case. And then those burdens become additive onto them. You know, if you get COVID to a position where it only affects the most vulnerable, then it's layering on top of other chronic illnesses.
100%. You
know, maternal mortality, or like all the rest of it. Like
100%. That's not only the effect, that's also part of the cause.
Right.
It's part of the reason why part of the reason why we get away with it.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, as we have discussed before, this ain't going to be the last pandemic. So this is our chance to, in the end game of COVID, to set up systems that are going to protect us in the future. And wouldn't you know it, those are the same systems that would help us manage the slide into endemicity a little bit more easily.
Right. Well, I want to thank you for coming on your favorite podcast.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure.
And on our podcast too. That's right. I talked about the small prize you won earlier. And I think people are assuming that it's the In the Bubble prize for best episode.
Absolutely.
But in addition to that, you were honored with a Pulitzer Prize for your work over the past years. And I just want to say, I'm guessing it even means more to you that the reaction to you winning that award was so universally, there are very few things in people where I've seen hundreds and hundreds of people universally saying, wow, the right thing just happened. And I know you weren't necessarily one of them because it's not the kind of thing you were looking for. But I hope that reaction to your winning the prize, you do focus on because you are a gift.
Thanks, Andy. That means a lot. And I did appreciate it. The outpouring was immense, and I felt it all very much. It's not the kind of work that I was expecting or hoping to do, and it's not work that I ever hoped would be necessary, but I'm glad that it is helpful to people.
It really is. It really is.
All right. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it. You take care of yourself.
Okay, thank you to Ed. A couple things to look forward to. If one Pulitzer Prize winning journalist in a week isn't enough, Lori Garrett is on the show on Wednesday. We get into another intense conversation, but a really kind of one of the more sciencey conversations. I really ask her to take us through how does this all work, like really work, and she's just so great at explaining it. And then next week, a couple great shows. One of them is going to be a toolkit on boosters with David Agus, the physician who will talk about the science around boosters, and Tom Moriarty, a senior executive from CVS, who's going to talk about booster distribution and answer your questions on this toolkit. Have a great rest of the week. If you're looking for stuff to do, just go back and listen to old episodes and tell your friends. Thanks. I hope everybody stays safe. Bye. Thanks for listening to In the Bubble. Hope you rate us highly on your podcast apps. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease and Alex McCohen produced the show. Our mix is by Ivan Kuriev. Jessica Cordova-Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax are the executive producers of this show. We love them dearly. Our theme was composed by Dan Malad and Oliver Hill, with additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media, and you can find me at aslavitt on Twitter or at andyslavitt on Instagram. If you do like what you heard today, please tell your friends, and please stay safe. Share some joy. We will definitely get through this together.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, friends, it's Meghan Trainor.
And her big bro, Ryan Trainor.
And her husband, Daryl Sabara.
Each week on our podcast, Working On It, we share behind-the-scenes stories and bring you into our hilarious and heartfelt conversations, and sometimes with amazing guests.
We tackle everything from navigating Hollywood to mental health to Meghan becoming a mother, Daryl becoming a father, and so much more.
We'll get into the nitty-gritty of our lives and leave no detail behind. Prepare to laugh, cry, and hopefully learn something new.
Listen to new episodes out every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.